sounds that works. I've heard some of the greatest communicators in the country use similar phrases like, I hear you, sir, but, and I got that, ma'am, but, or I believe that, sir, but, or that's a fact, but. These strip phrases deflect the insults coming at you and allow you to focus on what you're doing. Four reasons to employ strip phrases. First, strip phrases actually make you feel good. Normally, when you react in a pressure situation with phrases that make you feel good, you're probably doing no good. Because reacting to insults in a way that makes you feel good usually means you have reacted in kind. But strip phrases make you feel legitimately good because you're being tactical and are responding, not reacting, to the problem. Keeping your cool and remaining professional. When you react, you're being controlled by the situation. When you respond, you're dealing with it. See Chapter 27 for a fuller explanation of the difference. When I worked in the canine unit, the animal assigned to me was a police attack dog when his collar was on, and a family pet when that collar came off. Mama and the kids could roll around with that dog as long as his collar was off. The moment you put his collar on, he went back to work. And then nobody messed with him. I use strip phrases when I have my professional collar on, and I relax on my own time. Second, deflectors serve as what I call a springboard focus technique. Strip phrases springboard you over all the insults that might otherwise allow the person, a speeder, subordinate, angry child, complaining customer, to defeat you. Once you have avoided the hurled insult, you have springboarded to the word but. Which brings me to Thompson's Law of the Street, which can be applied everywhere. After the word but, use only words that serve your professional purpose. Understand that, sir, but I need to see your driver's license. I appreciate that, but I need to see some identification. Everything after the but is designed to get the job done. Third, if you can springboard past the insults and focus on the goal, you have disempowered the other person. Say you are a clerk and someone comes into your store and blames you for a shirt that fell apart. He insults you, calls you incompetent, and questions your heritage. Your first reaction might naturally be, hold on here, don't blame me. You're not going to get any satisfaction if you take that tone. But notice, if you ignore the insult and springboard over it with an apology and, I appreciate that, you have disempowered him. You're winning, and you're feeling good. Fourth, when you use these tactical phrases, you sound good. It's not enough to be good. You've also got to sound good, or it's no good. Because you lose credibility with anyone who overhears it. Springboarding allows you to sound good under pressure. Before I move into a couple of hints for dealing with difficult people, I should add that there are times when it is good not to use strip phrases. When you sense that the strip phrase might be a danger in itself, because the person is agitated that you're clearly deflecting and not dealing with the conflict at hand, skip the strip phrases and deal with the issues immediately. Two principles for dealing with difficult people. If you understand and agree with my four reasons for using strip phrases, feel free to develop your own. Consider them your ammunition, like arrows in a quiver. Keep them readily accessible so you can use them without thinking. They will allow you to keep two principles before you at all times when dealing with difficult people. Principle number one, let the person say what he wants as long as he does what you say. I even tell cops that. I say, let them chip at you as long as they're cooperating with you. What do you care what they say? Your attitude should be, say what you want, but do as I say. The only time this would not work is when the words the citizen uses serve only to inflate him with adrenaline, making him or his companions more of a problem. The officer has to carefully watch a person's body language to see when he might explode from his own initiative. It's important to intervene before these situations get out of hand. In a business setting, remember that insulting people don't mean what they're saying anyway, so what do you care what they say? They are upset. Focus on their behavior. Not on their attitude. As long as they are doing what you need them to do, let their mood blow over. Principle number two, always go for the win-win solution. I tell cops, look, You can give the citizen the last word because you have the last action. Let the perpetrator talk all he wants. You have the authority and the power to arrest him if necessary. If the civilian wants to shoot off his mouth to save face in front of his friends or family, that doesn't hurt you. Most of the verbal abuse cops get tends to be like the ink of a squid. It lets people hide, sounding good, even if they're not looking good. If you both take away people's last word and have the last act, you create violent scenarios and make enemies. Let them spout off. They win, you win. A most important distinction. Another critical distinction I make for police officers, which everyone ought to know, is the difference between the word respect and the word respect. Respect is what we have to show all people at all times. We cannot respect people who prey on others, people who beat their spouses, people who brutalize their children. I have no respect for lawbreakers, but when as a professional I deal with them, I must always show them respect. That is the golden rule in a single word. I know that is a difficult and fine line to draw because the words are spelled the same, sound nearly the same, except for the emphasis on different syllables, and seem to mean the same. But think of it this way. Re, in Latin, means to give back, as in giving back what you want under identical conditions. Alt, R-E in Latin, means to give back, as in giving back what you want under identical conditions. So, always treat the other person as you would want to be treated under identical conditions, even if he is not worthy of your respect. In other words, even in the process of arresting you, or firing you, or disciplining you, I must extend to you the kind of behavior I would expect were I in your shoes. When we disrespect people, put them down in front of others, or make them feel bad, we lose our power and create more enemies. We lose our professional face. We get upset, we use language irresponsibly, and we no longer have a disinterested state of mind. We're no longer great warriors of words. We've become part of the problem. If you can learn to deal skillfully with people under pressure, you can dance where others stumble. And that is the hallmark of the communication samurai. Respect to all, with dignity, pride, and assertiveness. Chapter 10. The Only Way to Interrupt People and Still Have Them Love You. One of the most powerful verbal tools I know is paraphrasing. To paraphrase, put most simply, is to put another person's meaning into your words and deliver it back to him. If you're taking abuse, you want to somehow intrude so you can make the diatribe a conversation. Then you can cast what you think lies behind his aggressive words, his real point, in your own words, which will be calmer because you're not the emotionally charged one here. And be sure that you have heard it correctly. When you paraphrase like that, you have actually inserted yet a third person into a two-person dialogue. Suddenly, you have not his words with his meaning or your words with your meaning, but your words with his meaning. I'll get into the 14 reasons why this is so effective, but first, how do you do this? There are two basic steps. The Sword of Insertion. This weapon is that single sentence that allows you to cut into a tirade and take control. It's hard to stop people talking. They are upset, and they can't be told, "Get to the point." All that you will get is, "I am getting to the point, you're not listening." And don't tell people to shut up or to calm down or to let you talk, because they won't shut up, they won't calm down, and they won't let you talk. So you start with the Sword of Insertion. A wedge into the harangue like, "Whoa," or "Listen," spoken earnestly, not in anger, or "Wait a second." The ultimate empathetic sentence. Here then is the powerful sentence that will allow you to interrupt anyone without fear of bodily harm. "Let me be sure I heard what you just said." This simple sentence is so empathetic, so full of conciliation and cooperation, so pregnant with sincerity, that you'll hardly ever see someone let it slide by. What you're saying, in essence, is, "Let me be sure I understand you. Let me be sure we're on the same wavelength. Let me be sure I heard that." You have become the personification of empathy. Everything about that sentence says you're trying to understand. No matter how upset, just about anyone will shut up and listen because she too wants to be sure you heard what she said. In fact, the surer she is that you are not listening, the more likely she is now to hear you out, if only to prove you wrong. 14 Benefits of Paraphrasing. 1. Magically, in one sentence, by paraphrasing, you've hooked the other person. He's listening. Using the sort of insertion with that sentence is the only way I know to interrupt somebody without generating further resistance. 2. You have taken control because you're talking and he is listening. 3. You're making sure of what you heard right on the spot, not finding out later you misunderstood. 4. If you have not heard the person accurately, he can correct you. That fills your pockets with ammunition. The more you know about somebody, the better and the more he speaks, the more he reveals about his emotions, his prejudices, and his assumptions. That can only help you in deflecting insults, keeping his attention, and generating voluntary compliance. 5. You have made the other person a better listener, because no one listens harder than he does to his own point of view. You're telling him, "Here's what I hear you saying," and you can bet he wants to hear that. 6. You've created empathy. The other person will believe you're trying to understand. Whether you really are interested is irrelevant. What's important is that he thinks that you are, and nothing makes him more certain than the sort of insertion sentence, "Whoa, let me be sure I heard what you just said." 7. Once you have thrust the sort of insertion and pronounced the ultimate empathetic sentence, you have gained attention. Then to effect this 7th benefit of paraphrasing, you want to immediately follow up with something like this. Okay, you are feeling X because of Y, true? The X equals an emotion, like anger or frustration, and the Y equals a reason. You don't even have to be right. You're guessing at this point. For instance, it might go like this. Whoa, listen, let me be sure I understand what you're saying. You're feeling angry because you believe I purposely undermined you in front of your colleagues yesterday at the meeting. Now the person can correct either the emotion you used for X or the reason you used for Y. He might say, "Well, no, I'm not angry, I'm disappointed." Now you're getting somewhere. Whether he's angry or disappointed will make a difference in where you go from there. Or he might modify X, the reason. "Yeah, I'm angry, but I'm not saying you purposely did it." Notice that my being right is not the issue. Making the attempt to get it right is the issue, because I'm appearing concerned, and it allows the upset person to modify his original statements. And that's the 7th benefit of paraphrasing. He's becoming more reasonable, without your having to vainly shout, "Be reasonable," which never works. 8. Paraphrasing overcomes a strange phenomenon I call sonic intention. People often think they have said something because they heard themselves say it in their mind, or because they had so carefully rehearsed it. Have you ever argued with your spouse about what was said the night before? You say, "You never said that." And he or she says, "Oh, yes, I did." Those arguments go on and on. What do you learn from this? Bottom line, if people think they said something, they said it, and no amount of argument or evidence will change their minds. My advice in a situation like that is to give in, because I've tried arguing, and I always wound up sleeping in the pickup truck. 9. This advantage to using paraphrasing is that it has a clarifying effect for people standing around. When you're dealing with a difficult person in public, whether in a store or an office or on the street, you don't want to be overheard sounding badly. Remember the ancient principle: look good, sound good, or no good. Paraphrasing is gentle. It tones down the volume and makes a diatribe a conversation. There should be no condemnation in the completely disinterested voice, the essence of effective paraphrasing. Paraphrasing should make me sound as if I'm trying to work on the problem rather than react to the problem. 10. The 10th advantage of paraphrasing is that it prevents metaphrasing, which I define as putting words, especially inaccurate ones, into other people's mouths. Metaphrasing is a perversion of paraphrasing. Too often, we're so concerned about what people ought to be saying that we paraphrase them as we would have said it. That always insults and angers people. Metaphrasing is useful only under one condition. If you're working as a dispatcher, working the emergency phones, often you have to take control of a verbal encounter and extract information quickly. You'll want to use step one of paraphrasing, the sort of insertion. Whoa, whoa. Let me be sure I heard what you just said. But then, instead of paraphrasing, move right to metaphrasing. In short, the person never again gets into the encounter except to answer pertinent questions. You're guiding the conversation quickly. There's somebody in the back of your house? Can you see him? Does he have a weapon? Is he moving? Clarify your address for me again. We have officers on the way. What is the man doing? Can he see you? From that point on, the person who might otherwise panic and become hysterical and of no help is giving you information. Though your approach may sound aggressive, it shows tremendous concern. It gives the comforting impression that you are helping, that you are in control. Frightened people usually calm down when they think their crisis is finally being handled by somebody who cares. I once heard the story of a lady who lived on a street corner where traffic accidents were common. She learned over the years to deal forthrightly with people who were injured or scared. One day, a particularly hellacious collision resulted in an old woman being trapped in a car and her son, a middle-aged man, running to the corner house in a panic. "I don't want my mama to die out there," he wailed. The lady met him at the door with blankets and a bottle of water and information. "I have already called the paramedics, and they're on their way," she said. "Keep your mother warm and calm until they get here." I asked how she knew someone was trapped in a car. "Because he came running. As soon as I heard the collision, I called 911 and grabbed the blankets and the bottle. I knew the first thing out of his mouth would be the nature of the trouble, and I could tell by his face that he was frantic. I figured if I seemed to have things under control and could convince him his loved one needed to be kept calm, he would have to calm down, too." In most other situations, metaphrasing does not work well, and paraphrasing is preferable. 11. You can ask for reverse paraphrasing to be sure the other person understands you. If you want to be a better supervisor or ensure that your children understand you, ask that they paraphrase back to you what they take to be your meaning. I found that up to 7 of 10 people will misread a document and miss the point. More horrifying, 8 of 10 misunderstand most verbal exchanges. It's easy to talk, but it's hard to listen well. And when you ask someone, "Do you understand what I've just said?" very few people will admit they missed your point. The key is not to ask for a negative answer. Ask the person to tell you what you said, and you'll get an accurate reading how you've communicated. Remember, the responsibility for the understanding belongs to the speaker, not the listener. Your job is to get through. Be careful not to condescend by implying that you just know the person will misunderstand. Rather, put the onus on yourself. Ask him to repeat it back to you for your benefit. "To be sure I said what I intended to say, would you give back what you understand the point of this discussion has been?" People will do that, and it safeguards you. 12. You also safeguard yourself by paraphrasing back what your boss or your spouse or children say. It's possible your supervisor may not say exactly what he or she meant. If you don't get it right, are you going to win the argument later? You walk in with a report your boss asked for 2 weeks before, and he hits you with, "I told you I needed you in here at 10 o'clock so I could have that for my meeting at 11. This report's worthless now." You know full well he never said 10 o'clock, and you thought you were several hours early with it. Are you going to say, "You never said it had to be to you by 10? In the interest of truth, you might try that. But then he or she says, "I most certainly did, and that was the most important part of the assignment. What's the matter with you?" Argue that one, right or wrong, and you're liable to be arguing for the last time. Your only recourse at that point is to say, "I'm sorry, I must not have heard it." If you had paraphrased before you left the office the first time, your boss would have heard either that you missed the time deadline or that he or she forgot to mention it. It would be clarified, and your hard work would eventually pay off. Don't rely on others to always say what they mean, no matter what their position. Paraphrase it back. That makes you look good, and it ensures a top level of professional work. Besides, bosses love to hear themselves quoted. 13. Paraphrasing has an unusual psychological advantage I call generating the fair play response. Whoever you're paraphrasing is almost psychologically forced to play by the same rules and paraphrase you. People will generally treat you the way you treat them. It's kind of the golden rule again, applied to communication. Treat others as you would want to be treated under identical circumstances. So if you use paraphrasing, if you work people skillfully, they're apt, even despite their intentions, to give you equal time. 14. Finally, when you paraphrase, it etches the facts in your mind. If you have to write a report or you're phoning information back to your boss about the facts of a meeting, the paraphrasing reinforces your own memory. Your report, written or oral, will be more concise and more accurate. Because the amazing tool of paraphrasing provides these 14 different benefits, you see why I call it the most powerful tool in communication. Chapter 11. Verbal Judo versus Verbal Karate. At the risk of oversimplifying, let me assert that there are really only two kinds of language, verbal judo and verbal karate. Judo, as I've pointed out, was developed as a sport of self-defense without the use of weapons. Karate is defined as a self-defense system characterized by sharp, quick blows delivered with the hands and feet. Thus, to me, verbal karate is the lashing out, as if with the side of a calloused hand, when you snap at your spouse, your children, your employer, your employees, anyone. Whenever you use in a harmful and destructive way those words that rise readily to your lips, you have employed the easiest use of language, verbal karate. In the professional realm, verbal karate is the unprofessional use of language, because you're using words to express your personal feelings. You're not connecting with your audience, and basically you're off target. Physical karate is a fighting, striking, kicking, attacking offensive system. When that approach is transferred to oral communication, it's easy to do, but it doesn't work. After 35 years of using both physical karate and verbal karate professionally, I can tell you the latter never once helped me, and I was an expert at it. In fact, verbal karate burned more bridges, alienated more people, and lost more opportunities for me than anything else I can think of. Oh, it often made me feel good about myself temporarily. I'd tell somebody off with my combination of educated articulation, physical prowess and presence, and macho tone of voice, and I'd strut away thinking, I told him, you bet I did, he had it coming. A few hours later, without fail, I was thumping my forehead thinking, I should have said something else. Why did I say that? Why did I have to shoot off my big mouth? The bad news. Of course, I usually had to go back and do some apologizing. The bad news is, there is no apology for verbal abuse. The best you can hope for is a shortened version of the word, like apologize, much as I use with my strip phrases, because there is simply no taking back harmful words. You can say you take them back, but ask a person a decade later if he remembers your unkind words. Chances are, he will. People never forget verbal abuse. It sinks deeper and festers longer than any other kind of abuse. I'd rather be cut with a sword than with an insult from someone I care about. Think of the times in your childhood you were humiliated by teachers or colleagues or peers. Have you forgotten them? That's why we must learn to use language more skillfully. That's why we must eschew verbal karate and embrace verbal judo. The gentle way. Physical judo was invented by a Dr. Kano in 1882. It was a derivative of jujitsu, which means pain. Judo, as I mentioned in Chapter 4, means the gentle way, rather than the painful way. If you've ever seen a judo match, you may wonder what's gentle about it. People are thrown or foot swept to the mat. The gentleness lies in the technique. You are not counteracting their approach and hammering back at them. Rather, you are moving with them, using their momentum to pull them off balance and then propelling them to the ground. The way you throw someone allows him to break the fall and roll out of it. Verbal judo, then, should be non-hurtful. It should be redirective rather than confrontational. Kelly in the car. All martial arts are based on redirection. I learned the concept of redirection when I first tried to put together a course in oral communication. I'd been divorced, primarily because I didn't know how to use language, and I'd snapped one too many times at my former spouse. And my then 16-year-old daughter Kelly came to live with me in Albuquerque. Apparently she was having trouble using words at home, too. A few weeks after moving in with me, Kelly came to me with a request. "Dad, I'm working part-time and I'm going to high school and I gotta have a car." Well, I was trying to start a business and I was broke. I was living in a little condo and trying to keep up with the bills. So frankly, Kelly's request, as legitimate as it may have been, made me mad. How presumptuous. What an ingrate. I wanted to say, "That's outrageous. What a request. How can you be so irrational as to think I have the money for that right now?" These words welled up, but maybe I had learned enough about snapping at loved ones that I was able to control myself. Instead, because I was working on these principles, I said, "Well now, Kelly, if I were to buy you a car, you would, of course, maintain it completely, true?" "Oh yes, Dad, oh yes." I said, "Why don't you go check out what that means, and then let's talk." Frankly, all I was doing was putting her off. I just needed her out of my hair, because otherwise I was not about to handle myself well. A couple of days later, she said, "Dad, buy me a bicycle." I said, "What? What happened to the car?" She said, "Are you kidding? Do you have any idea what maintenance and insurance would cost me? And then there's licensing and processing fees, to say nothing of gas and oil. I can't afford a car. Why don't you buy me a bike?" I thought, "Great, George. You just saved thousands." But she continued, "You know, Dad, I notice you're beginning to travel, leaving your car at the airport and paying for parking. It must be lonely going to the airport and arriving home late at night, no one to meet you. It's not good for your car to be out there for days in cold weather. So why don't you buy me a bike, and while you're in town, I ride bike, you drive car. But I will arrange my social life so I can take you to the airport on time and pick you up on time, making it easier for you. That way I can drive the car while you're away, and you drive it when you're here." Of course, Kelly's was a great plan and worked out well. Without realizing it, I had redirected her attention, and I avoided getting upset and starting a confrontation which could have lasted for weeks. Confrontation wouldn't have worked. Redirection did, and freed her to be more creative than I would have been. Verbal judo had come to life for the very one who had discovered and hoped to promote it. Without realizing it, Kelly had actually employed verbal judo on me. Mastery through adapting. Verbal judo is simply the use of words to achieve your objective. You've got to stay in contact with your audience and use your words with maximum effectiveness and minimum effort. Why stir people up? There's a kind of mastery available through adapting. I didn't reject Kelly's request. I let it drift and refocused her attention until she became creative. I was becoming aware that verbal judo was the martial arts of the mind and the mouth, the ability to keep calm inside, to read the audience and find the right words for the right person at the right time. Aristotle said that audiences are made, not found. You can trip over people who are angry and hostile, but if you're skillful, you can calm and redirect their behavior in 2 minutes. Force options. The goal of persuasion is to generate voluntary compliance. You can't expect it just because you play a certain authority role. You must make it happen. The great communicators have that art. They somehow get people to do what they want them to do by getting them to want to do it. What force options are available to generating voluntary compliance? The first, surprisingly enough, is your mere presence. The way you show up, the way you approach, carry yourself, stand around, even the way you project your feelings onto your face. I teach police officers and corporate people the importance of professional presence, how they look as they enter a scene. Consider, for example, a typical mistake, using the wrong facial expression, often with the wrong words. Many think they are going to cool people down and take charge of a situation by showing an angry, eyes-squinted-up, snarling face. That calms nobody down. If you want to calm somebody, don't you think it would be more helpful to affect a calm, pleasant, interested look? How many faces? You have to have one face to calm somebody, another face to look interested, another to look concerned, and another when someone's trying to intimidate you. We all wear dozens of faces every day. Which you use when will determine how successful you are in generating voluntary compliance, the goal of persuasion, and an underlying tenet of verbal judo. The Mount Rushmore frozen service face is the kind you run into too often in businesses, government offices, or even hospitals. People just don't look happy. How about in retail stores where clerks wear smile buttons but look thunderous? Those faces are inappropriate. Learn the skill of the chameleon, an image I have mounted on a pin and give out at my seminars. The chameleon is a good representation of an effective communicator because of its ability to adapt to its environment. Just as the chameleon changes colors to blend in, you must wear faces appropriate to changing situations. The chameleon survives because it adapts. No matter how you feel inside, you must develop the ability to look good on the outside, to reinforce what you're saying with a face and a demeanor that fits the situation. This is hardly taught anywhere. When I ask police officers across the country to name their first force option, they usually tell me verbalization. Not true. It is a professional presence to look good. You've got to look the part. Force option number two is verbalization. The right words for the right person at the right time. As Napoleon said, "More powerful than a standing army is the well-wrought word." Most of us do not communicate skillfully under pressure, yet our entire careers depend on it. I've already covered why calm down doesn't calm anybody down. Why not use a phrase like, "It's going to be all right, I'm working on it." If people in crisis would remember these first two overriding force options, they would go a long way in improving communication. Without any other training or skill, they'll be on the right track by using the right words and having the right demeanor. Four more force options. If words fail, and at times they do, go then to force option three, laying hands on a person and using techniques from the martial arts called the come-along holds. Obviously, these are limited to law enforcement personnel, and they help generate voluntary compliance at the lowest level of pain possible. Option number four is the use of artificial incapacitators, chemical mace, stun guns, the kind of force that temporarily immobilizes so the police officer can generate voluntary compliance. The fifth option, using impact tools like the nightstick or the baton, is not designed to permanently injure or brutalize people. These impact tools are to be used to generate voluntary compliance at a higher level of pain than the others, but only when necessary. Option number six is deadly force. And, of course, that has nothing to do with generating voluntary compliance. Deadly force is used for enforced compliance, and there are strict rules, such as imminent jeopardy and preclusion, meaning no other force options are available, that tell us when such extreme measures are allowed. Obviously, for most people, the force options are much more limited. Your options. In corporate America or at home, it's important that you know the next force option after words fail. Since you can't cuff someone or subdue him with a stick or draw down on him, much as you would like to occasionally, be honest, it is crucial that your next move has some teeth in it. Is it a written warning, some kind of a transfer, a loss of money or privilege? One of the secrets of being a good communicator is knowing the system. Be sure you are well-versed in policy. Too many people use threats they don't have the power to carry out. How about the mother who tells a toddler, near midnight at a family Christmas bash she had no business subjecting him to, "If you don't behave, I'll put you out in the car." Right. Know what you can enforce and at what level you can enforce it. That gives you confidence and credibility. Credibility, which is rooted in the Latin word credo, meaning I believe, begins and ends with your use of words. The birth of my ability to communicate came in my acceptance of the fact that I was the problem. If you can accept that the problem with your spouse, your children, or your workplace may be in your mirror, you can make dramatic changes in your ability to be skillful under pressure. Focus on technique. Focus on the goal. Your ability to survive professionally and domestically lies with your ability to use words skillfully. And sometimes that means moving to tougher force options. While you don't have the tools of the police officer, or, I hope, the need for them, there is a system to handle the tougher-than-usual encounters. Chapter 12. The Five-Step Hard Style. Over nearly the last two decades, I have taught verbal judo to almost 70,000 cops in nearly 700 police departments, and to thousands more in corporate and retail America. When I teach, I also learn. And if there's one thing I've learned from all these frontline communicators, it's this. If someone wants to ruin your credibility and get the advantage over you, all he has to do is make you angry enough to misuse words. I believe that more than 90% of your success will lie in your delivery style. So I want to provide you with a series of principles to live by and to enact on a daily basis, making you more effective as a parent, a professional, and a friend. Discovered the hard way. Persuasion, generating voluntary compliance, is the essence of verbal judo, and at the heart of persuasion is a five-step model I discovered the hard way in police work. It suggests that you, 1, ask, ethical appeal, 2, set context, reasonable appeal, 3, present options, personal appeal, 4, confirm, practical appeal, and 5, act, determination of appropriate action. For a full discussion of the four types of appeals, see Chapter 21. Obviously, this didn't all come to me in a flash. Less than a week after I got in trouble with the police chief over my brusque manner with citizens, remember in Chapter 3 all that hassling with offenders, I stopped another guy at about 3 a.m. He had ignored several stop signs, and when I approached his car, I saw a whiskey bottle on the floor. I snapped, "You, sir, step out." When I got the familiar response, "I'm not getting out of this car," I thought, "Oh no, here we go again." I didn't want another tongue-lashing from the chief, so I thought quickly and came at him from a slightly different direction. Let me remind you, I didn't know what I was doing was right. I was just scrambling to try to stay out of trouble and still get my job done. I softened my tone and said, "Sir, listen to me. There's a whiskey bottle by your right leg. Now, sir, that constitutes under the law what we call an open bottle charge. I have no choice but to have you step out, because I'm required to enter your vehicle and take a look at that bottle. For your safety and mine, sir, department policy says I have to ask you to step out. Would you do that for me?" Make no mistake, I felt like a wimp at first. What I really wanted to do was pin the guy to the ground, cuff him up, and rough him up, and let him know he was tangling with the wrong lawman. You bet I did. But I was not going to let this guy get my goat or my job. My calmer voice showed I was more in control. I switched from commanding to asking, and then I set the context by telling him why I was making my request. The word context is crucial in all communication. Context comes from the Latin contexo, contextus, or possibly the Latin con and texo. Both mean weave together or join. I have come to learn that of 10 drivers who are difficult people, see Chapter 5, and refuse to get out of the car at first request, at least 7 will do what you say if you only tell them why. One of the great psychological urges in this country is the desire to know. If you can tap into that and let people know why you're saying what you're saying, you can usually generate voluntary compliance. Give them context. Weave together the elements of the situation. When I set context, I grounded myself in professionalism. I gave reasons, policies, and procedures for what I was asking. My ego, so prevalent in that first command, "Get out," was then missing. Your personal face will always create conflict because you virtually force the public, especially the difficult people who are wired that way, to come back at you. Hardly realizing it, I had substituted my professional face for my personal face. I had moved from the ethical appeal of asking to a reasonable appeal of setting context. Unfortunately, I had run into one of the few difficult people not motivated by having the request put into context. This guy required my going to step three, presenting options and making a personal appeal, because he said, "I don't know nothing about that bottle, Jack. I took a bunch of guys to a party last night and they drank whiskey. I don't even drink whiskey. Not my bottle, not my problem. I'm not getting out." I gotta tell you, George Thompson, the civilian, would just as soon have run his nightstick through one of the guy's ears and out the other. But I'm a practical man. I like strokes as much as the next guy, and I didn't want my chief on my case again. I tried a new approach, coming at the driver from yet another direction. I said, "Sir, listen, that's an interesting distinction between whether it's your bottle or your buddy's. But the law does not make that distinction. The law says, bottle in car, you driver, you responsible. Now, sir, that might not even be fair, but 'tis so under the law. I'd like to think you'd cooperate with me. Step on out, sir. I can check that bottle, then I can chat with you about why I stopped you in the first place. That way it looks as if you're going to be able to go home tonight, put your feet up, be with your family, eat at your own table, sleep in your own bed, and get up in the morning and go to work. I'd like to think you'd want to do that, sir, but the law gives you another option if you wish. The law says if you want, you can come with us, eat with us, stay overnight, sleep with us. That's called an arrest. Now, I don't see any need to do that. That's a lot of paperwork for me, that's towing your car, and you know they'll put dents on that thing down at the yard. You don't need that kind of trouble, do you, sir? Why don't you give us both a break and cooperate with me and step on out of there?" Those were options, not threats, and they worked. Basically, all I told the guy was he could get out of the car or go to jail. But notice that I'd left the power of choice with him. Notice also how specific I was. Specificity is one of the secrets of persuasion, helping people see what you want them to see. I tried to paint a picture of his going home, the problem over, contrasted with a picture of his coming with me, having his car towed, and going to jail. Those specifics made his choice clear and easy. I knew I'd hit on something when the guy laughed and said, "I don't need that kind of trouble, officer," and stepped out. Best of all, and here's the point, he lost no face, and he stepped out onto ground that I had created for him. The what ifs. What if he hadn't stepped out? Or what if your adversary still doesn't cooperate when you've reached the third step of the five-step hard style? Unless you're a cop, you may have met your match. Just for the sake of illustration, let me tell you what police officers sometimes have to do. They must move to what I call practical appeal, which is to confirm the resistance. Until my course began reaching police departments across America, cops really had no option at that point but to haul people out of their cars using come-along holds. My contention is that there is one optional sentence left that still gives a troublemaker a chance to do the right thing and save further hassle. If he hasn't pulled a weapon, there's a powerful sentence worth trying, and one you can use with your children, co-workers, or troublesome customers. It's this: "Is there anything I can say or do at this time to earn your cooperation?" And then I always follow it with the optimistic, "I'd sure like to think there is." Notice how pleasant and positive that is. I've seen this work on the street in tough cities in California and in Seattle, Washington. I saw this work with a guy who had fought the cops 17 straight times before an officer tried this fourth step, the confirmation, which confirms whether or not the person will cooperate. If this doesn't work, and very occasionally it doesn't, then the officer must act. Step five. Interestingly for cops working in pairs, is that the practical appeal question tips off the partner that step five is next. If the perpetrator makes it clear that there is nothing that can be said or done to gain his cooperation, it's time for action. I've alerted my partner, who is then moving to the next position, without having warned the subject. The wrong language in that situation, the "if you don't do this, I'm going to do that" approach, always warns people that we're about to act, making them dangerously ready for us. If I say to a subject, "Get out, or I'm going to take you out," he may come at me with a razor blade. But my suggested sentence is so pleasant that it keeps him off balance. It allows me to justify my action later in court and sound good, and it alerts my partner without alerting the perpetrator. Now if the guy says, "That's right, I'm not getting out," the cop takes him out before he finishes the next sentence. Using this at home. Most of us have not been trained to deal with teenagers. Up to about age 11 or 12, kids may give us some trouble, but basically they follow our directions. By the time they get to be 13 or so, they enter the Y generation. Everything that was once accepted is now questioned. I don't know about you, but that's where I found myself less effective than ever as a parent. No one ever told me how to persuade a teenager, but now I know that the 5-step hard style is the key to persuasion. For example, suppose I were to tell my son, "Taylor, before you go to the party, take the trash out." I might hear something like, "Hey, Dad, I haven't got time to do it tonight. I'm in a rush. Why don't you do it?" "Why don't I do it?" Most of us would snap at that response. We don't set context or lay out options. We just move right to step 3 and turn options into threats. "Hey, you don't take the trash out, you don't go out." Of course, all that gets you from the teenager is, "That's unfair, I have to do everything, you never do anything, blah, 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 blah." Suddenly you've got yourself a serious argument. Why not pleasantly go to step 2, setting context? "Taylor, remember when we agreed 6 months ago that your allowance would be partially based on getting that trash to the curb every Friday night before going out? Why don't you just keep your word and do it?" For some kids, appealing to their honor works immediately, as it usually does with my son. But what if you have a difficult teenager? You're apt to hear, "Yeah, well, I meant to talk to you about that allowance business anyway. I'm fed up with that. Get someone else to take the trash out because I'm in a hurry." Now it's time to go setting and creating options instead of threats. Something like this might work. "Taylor, listen, we agreed. When cans by curb, Taylor out for parties." You don't have to physically take them out. Your job is to see that they get out. If you want to bribe your sister or get mama to take them out, or you want to use voodoo, I don't care. No cans out, no party. At this point, most kids would probably do it. There's been no assault on Taylor's personal face, and he can maintain his dignity by simply taking the trash out. But suppose he doesn't. Suppose he says, "I'm not going to do it, I'm in a hurry." Then you have no choice. You move right to step 4. "Taylor, listen. Is there anything I can say or do at this time to earn your cooperation and get you to keep your word and take the trash out? I'd sure like to think there is." I don't know about your kids, but most kids know by that sentence that discussion is about over. The teenager can still take out the trash at that point and lose no credibility, no personal face. But if he doesn't, you can ground him, send him to his room, take away his allowance, or whatever punishment is appropriate in your house. But notice that he cannot blame you. In the end, it was his choice. The punishment is an appropriate action based on a 4th step that he resisted. He had a right to resist. That's how he earns his identity over time, flexing his muscles. We have to give our kids room to flex. If we're always coming down on them, they can't grow. But they must pay the consequences if they do not obey. Once the line is drawn, they must not cross it without punishment. Up to that point, we owe them the courtesy of looking for the keys to voluntary compliance. The 5-step hard style is a communication tactic that arms you to deal with difficult people under almost any condition. It provides you with decisiveness and certainty. You will always know where you are. You're in the asking stage, step 1, the setting the context, telling why, stage step 2, the presenting of options in the other person's best interest stage, step 3, or the confirming that some kind of cooperation is either forthcoming or not stage, step 4. If not, you have to act. Step 5. You will never again be trapped into repeating orders over and over, which is a great sign of weakness in a parent, a police officer, an executive, or anyone in a position of authority. Repetition reveals weakness. Flexibility and variance of approach shows strength. Chapter 13. The First Great Communication Art, Representation. Your presence and your words, when skillfully combined, are knowledge and power in action. They allow you to generate voluntary compliance from the most difficult subjects. Now let me suggest that if you deal with people in any profession, you have an identity that can be very clearly defined, one in which you can take great pride. You can be a contact professional. Contact is an interesting word from the Latin con, meaning with, and tact, meaning to touch on all sides. I always emphasize the necessity of being a pro rather than an amateur. Amateurs have good days and bad days. They have not been trained to be tactical. A professional, for example, is someone like Michael Jordan. He plays the greatest basketball in the world game after game, but what really sets him apart is what he does under pressure. What does he do when you double-team him? I'll tell you what he does. He gets better. He passes more often. He passes better. He scores more. He has more assists. You should take pride in your ability to get better under the pressure people put on you in the workplace. To be a contact professional who can handle any kind of stress, you must exude credibility and an aura of power. In all the fancy courses I took and all the degrees I earned, I never had a course in how to handle my own weaknesses in interpersonal relationships. I learned this through experience in dealing with people. I learned that to be a contact professional, you must first, of course, be in contact with yourself. Most of us have weaknesses in dealing with people. What are yours? Is there a list of 5 or 6 things that get under your skin about difficult people? We all have buttons and triggers, but if you're going to work for others and represent them, you must not allow people to push your button or pull your trigger. The question is, how do you build a trigger guard? The answer, know thyself. The old samurai used to say that if you don't know yourself, you lose 100% of the time. The wanna bet guy? I discovered very early on as a police officer that one thing I hated was having my authority challenged. There was always somebody who'd say in a nasty, whiny, contentious voice, "You can't do that to me!" It seems I heard that 20 or 30 times a day, and it always angered me. Every time, a little voice went off in my head, "You wanna bet? Watch me!" Immediately, I would take a more aggressive, attacking stance, and each time I made errors, I was not able to explain them on paper or justify them to a superior. The only person who had ever said anything about that problem was the old Indian who taught me things while I was growing up. One day, when I was 11, he said out of the blue, "Thompson, someday you will have enemies. Here's how you handle them. First, always define. Then name them. Then you will own them." The Indian walked off into the forest, and I thought, "What? What does that mean?" It sounded kind of like some Indian folklore, and I hardly gave it another thought until I was 35. Then I was on the streets, making enemies, and not being able to handle them. I still didn't understand his advice, but I acted on it anyway. What did I have to lose? I knew my biggest enemy was anyone who challenged my authority. One day I wrote that down. I had defined him. Naming him was more difficult, but I finally decided to call him by the voice that went off inside of me. That voice always said, "Wanna bet?" So I called my enemy the "Wanna bet?" guy. I said to myself, "George, be careful of the wanna bet guy, or he'll own you somewhere, sometime." The very next night, I placed a young man under arrest, and he came back with, "You can't touch me. I'll do what I want. My father's on the city council. He'll have your job." Immediately, I thought, "Wanna bet?" But at the same time, a warning bell also went off in my head. "There he is, the wanna bet guy. Be careful. He's gonna get you." I literally took a step back, forcing myself to remain calm and not say or do anything that would jeopardize the integrity of that very legitimate arrest. I wanted the bust, all right. And I wanted it to stick because of the kid's snotty attitude. I could have lost it all, and maybe even my job, if I had let him get to me and make me do something stupid. I didn't, and he got in big trouble. To this day, you cannot challenge my authority and make me show anger. Sure, I'm still angry inside. My trigger has been cocked, but you can't pull it. My trigger guard is in place. I defined my enemy, and I named him. Now I own him, rather than the other way around. What is your enemy? Define it. Name it. Own it. The Teddy Bear Truth. I remained so intrigued by the power of that truth that about 10 years later, I asked a psychologist why it worked. He told me that when we define our weaknesses, or our so-called communication enemies, we actually bring them out and make them part of our consciousness. We admit them, bringing them into the light of recognition. We can name only that which we own, so when we name them, we acknowledge that we have taken ownership of them. If you've ever taken your child to a store and bought him a teddy bear from a whole group of similar-looking bears, you know that by the time you've gotten to the counter, your child has named the bear. And if that teddy bear is ever misplaced or missing, you see your child bereft and heartbroken because by naming it, he has made it part of who he is. For this reason, farmers don't allow their children to name the heifers or the chickens. You can't very well serve up Elsie or Tweety Bird on a plate. Make a list of your most harmful weaknesses, then name them. Give each a little tag and pin it wriggling to the wall of definition. Then you own them. Once you're in control inside, you can be in control outside. As a contact professional, you work in a highly visible world. You live and speak in a fishbowl. Every time you speak, people are watching you. There are a lot of eyes out there, so you have to be careful. Say only what you'd be proud to have quoted back to you on Monday morning. And that all starts with knowing and being in contact with yourself. Representation. To be a top-flight contact professional, you have to become an artist at representation, the first of three great communication arts. Besides being in contact with or knowing yourself, you must be in contact with your organization and its constituency. As you do your professional representation work, you stand between the proverbial rock and a hard place. Just for fun, sketch out an illustration that will make this clearer. Draw a circle with the name of whatever organization or company you represent in it. To the right of that, draw a 5-point star to represent you. To the right of that, draw a box with a C in it, which stands for your contact point, your constituency or customer or public. Every time you speak, you represent everything in the circle on the left, the rock, to the contact in the square on the right, the hard place. Now draw a figure 8, which represents your job. That begins on the left, passes through you, and continues to the right before coming back through you again. Continue to trace that figure 8, which signifies how you serve as a conduit between the two other entries in such a manner as to generate voluntary compliance. I emphasize that because it means you are continually serving as a conduit. Keep tracing that figure 8, and soon you'll see that you, the star, are virtually obliterated by your representational job. Now draw an arrow between the circle and the square, and you have a figure 8 with an arrow driven through the middle. That is the essence of representation, the ability to represent the spirit of your organization, its goods, its goals, its produce, its policies, its philosophy. It is that philosophy that you must fully know and embrace, because every time you open your mouth, you personify it to whomever you're talking to. If you do your job right, as I hope you drew your illustration, you've disappeared. And that's one of my crucial points. When you speak, you are a mouthpiece, a representative. You do not represent your own ego. Remember, the more ego you show, the less power you have over people. Egotists only create conflict. The great communicators put their egos behind them and put the purpose and goal of communication before them. Nobody likes people whose personalities intrude. If you're in a retail business, your job is to represent your organization in such a way as to not only get customers to buy the first time, but also to ensure they'll want to come back again and again. Nordstrom's was the first of many companies that has learned this art. It gave people pride in the organization. Every time you open your mouth, you represent the boss, whether that is the chief of police, the mayor,